Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to Heartland Politics here on KBURAM-FM, Burlington, Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today my focus is on one of the great unsolved mysteries in modern American history. If there's two things I'd love to know the answer to in my lifetime, it's who really assassinated John Kennedy and what happened to Jimmy Hoffa. Well, we're not going to solve the JFK murder today, but we are going to take a look back at the second of these topics and explore the Hoffa through the eyes of someone very close to this case. He's Jack Goldsmith. He's the stepson of Chucky O'Brien, who was like a son to Jimmy Hoffa and one of the closest confidants to the former Teamsters president. Jack is the author of a really, really good book that just came out called In Hoffa's Shadow, A Stepfather, A Disappearance in Detroit, and My Search for the Truth. He's with me today. Jack, thank you so much for taking the time today to be with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, this is really, to me, as somebody who lived through this era, I was a youngster at the time, just a fascinating book, and it's a topic of continuing discussion, as a lot of folks know who have Netflix and have seen the movie The Irishman, which we'll sprinkle in here. But start at the beginning here, your relationship to Chucky O'Brien and how this really developed into you pursuing an actual book about this case.
Yeah, sure. Let me start when I was a little boy. I was 12 years old in 1975, and my mom was divorced my dad, and she married a man, Chucky O'Brien. And Chucky was Hoffa's right-hand man, but he and Hoffa had split largely over my mom, it turns out. And they got married in June of 75. He was my new stepfather. I just loved him enormously. He was a great stepfather. And 6 weeks after they got married, Hoffa disappeared. And then a week after that, Chucky was the leading suspect. And so our life just kind of got enveloped by the really intense Hoffa investigation. So I kind of grew up with him being heavily investigated by the FBI. And so he was a great stepfather. And he was a great father to me. I mean, he adopted me, and I was very close to him. But then, to make a long story in the book short, we grew apart when I went to college. I basically cut him out of my life when I was about 25, because for many reasons that I discuss in the book, but mainly for selfish reasons, I was worried about what impact he would have on my career, my legal career. He had a lot of mobster friends. He was a leading suspect in the Hoffa disappearance. So I cut him out of my life, and then about 20 years later, we reconciled after a whole bunch of events I discuss in the book. And after we reconciled, I decided during conversations with him that I didn't think he did it because of some things he told me, and just thinking about the logic of why he was supposed to be involved. And so I decided to write a book about his relationship with Hoffa, my relationship with him, and kind of trying to give a fair and honest account of the disappearance.
And I think it was fair and honest. One of the things about this that I think, if there's people out there who are younger who are thinking, why is this such a big deal still? It is on several levels, but I think the importance of Jimmy Hoffa to American history and the American labor movement is worth you taking a minute here to kind of talk about why he was so significant in the history of this country, and in particular the labor movement and the middle class in America.
Yeah. So Hoffa, you know, he's known today through movies and books as being this mobbed up guy, which is an exaggeration. He definitely had a lot of contacts with the mafia, and he definitely did a lot of business with them, but he wasn't controlled by them at all. He was, to be fair to his critics, he didn't really care about complying with the law. He cared about one thing. He cared about helping the working people. He came up when he was a young kid. He went on strike when he was still a teenager in the middle of the Depression and won the strike. And he just had a bond with the working class starting in the 30s. And he was this extraordinary leader of the Teamsters Union, starting in Detroit with nothing. He had this magnetic personality. He attracted people to the union. He was a brilliant bargainer. And he figured out ways to use trucking power and the power of being able to control trucking routes to expand the Teamsters' powers. He brought hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people out of poverty in the 50s and 60s into the middle class, frankly. I mean, he was just extraordinarily successful. And he was a real working class hero. Probably in the 50s and 60s, at a time when labor unions were really important in this country, unlike today, he was the most powerful and the best known labor union leader. So he was a very consequential figure in the history of the American labor movement.
Now, your stepfather had connections through some of the folks that are featured in the movie The Irishman, Tony Pro, for example, and you knew some of these folks growing up.
Yeah, Tony Pro was Uncle Tony to me growing up. I knew him very well. I knew Anthony Giacalone, who's in the movie, very well. He was also Uncle Tony. Those are the two main characters in The Irishman that I knew as a boy.
So, I mean, Chucky, and you talk about this in the book, how close he and Hoffa were throughout. And Chucky was kind of, I think it's fair to say, unfairly maligned as we get through, and we'll talk about the FBI investigations later. But just maybe give a demonstration of how close they were and how he was really with him throughout all this formative period of Hoffa's career in the Teamsters.
Yeah, I mean, Chucky met Hoffa when he was 9 years old through his mother, a woman named Sylvia Pagano. And Sylvia Pagano was very close to Hoffa. She was very close to the mob in Detroit and elsewhere. She actually introduced Hoffa to the Detroit mafia. She introduced her son Chucky to Hoffa, and Hoffa immediately took a liking to Chucky when he was 9 years old. They were extremely close. Chucky went to work for him on weekends when he was 18 years old, and starting in the early 50s, he basically became his right-hand man and was always at his side until Hoffa went to jail in the 60s. He was his troubleshooter. He was his intelligence gatherer. He was his errand runner. He was his bodyguard. He pummeled a guy who once tried to shoot at Hoffa during a trial. He was really his right-hand man, not really his labor advisor. He wasn't the person who was helping Hoffa with the actual negotiations. He was like taking care of everything else, and they were extremely close. Hoffa called him his other son, and Chucky used to call Hoffa dad.
One of the very interesting parts of this was, and there have been a movie made about this, and it's ingrained in, I think, our history, is the battles between Jimmy Hoffa and Bobby Kennedy. I didn't realize the extent of the investigation, the investigations that were conducted against Hoffa. And it really made me stop and think. We see Bobby Kennedy as this crime fighter, trying to clamp down on this corrupt union. But wow, you really expose a lot of things here that I think I wasn't aware of.
Yeah, this is not well known in the public. It's well known in the legal world. Bobby Kennedy was famous for, frankly, abusing his power, both as the head of the investigation of the so-called McClellan Committee in the 1950s that was investigating labor corruption, and then when he was attorney general for his brother in the 60s. And when we study prosecutorial abuse in law school, Kennedy's pursuit of Hoffa and the tactics he used against him, throwing everything in the book against him and deciding that he was going to get him no matter what and trying to find ways to do it, it's a classic case of prosecutorial overreach. Now, to be clear, Hoffa was a figure who was corrupt by conventional means. He was making lots of money on the side. He committed violations of the law. But one of the things I point out in the book is that the same thing was going on the other side in different ways. And the government was cutting corners and violating ethics and, in some cases, the law to pursue him. And it just puts, I think it puts Hoffa and Kennedy in a little bit different light to see it through that lens.
Yeah, this was the most extensive investigation over 2 years. And that was, I think it was, like you mentioned, after six previous trials that he had gotten off on, they finally got him on jury tampering, I believe it was.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was actually 7 years. I mean, he pursued him for 7 years, starting in the 50s when he was the head of the McClellan Committee. For two brutal years, he threw everything that Congress could in terms of subpoenas and investigations and trying to catch him in lies. That didn't work. Hoffa survived six trials, and they finally got him on a seventh trial, there was jury tampering, not for labor malfeasance, not for having associations with the mob, but for tampering with the jury.
Which is what really started the first event that started this path down towards his disappearance. He comes out of prison and is trying to get his old position back.
Yes. So Hoffa went to prison in 67. I found some really interesting stuff, I think, about the machinations that went behind him getting out of prison. But Nixon finally commutes his sentence in December of 1971. But he puts a condition on it. He says, Hoffa, you can come out of jail early, but I'm not going to allow you to go back into labor. And to make a long story short, it was Hoffa's efforts to fight that labor condition that Nixon put on him and his efforts to be desperately get back the union that led him to be killed, because what had happened when Hoffa went to jail was that his assistant, Frank Fitzsimmons, who's also in the Scorsese film, Fitzsimmons took over, and the mob loved Fitzsimmons being in charge because they were able to just really take over the union and just extract the funds in a way that Hoffa didn't allow. And so Hoffa's efforts, as the movie portrays this more or less accurately, but most of the movie's not accurate, but this part is, Hoffa's effort to get back the control of his union that was taken away from him by when he went to jail, it led him to a clash with the mob that led them to kill him. That part of the story is correct.
After he gets out of jail, of course, he pursues that, as you mentioned, he pursues the Teamster presidency again. One of the interesting things in there was the connection with Watergate. I mean, it seems like the story keeps having tentacles that go out everywhere in different parts of American history. Did you find any evidence that the Teamsters provided money? Fitzsimmons gave money to the presidential campaign of Richard Nixon, which then made it hands into the pockets of the Watergate burglars.
Yes, so some of that has been known. It's been known that the Teamsters gave a lot of money to Nixon in '68 and in '72. Nixon and Fitzsimmons and the Teamsters were very, very close. The Teamsters Union endorsed Nixon in the '72 election, which unions never endorsed Republicans. And the Teamsters gave him just enormous amounts of money. But one thing that wasn't known is that Hoffa himself gave $1 million of his own money to Nixon, basically as a payoff to get out of jail. And the Watergate investigators, there's a lot. I think that chapter on Nixon and Hoffa, I thought it was one of the most interesting chapters in the book because of all the incredible stuff I dug up in the Nixon archives that really hasn't been gone over before, about all the things that Nixon did scheming with Fitzsimmons and people in his government to let Hoffa out but not let him take control of the Teamsters again so that Nixon could have his cake and eat it too, because he liked Fitzsimmons better than Hoffa. And Nixon made $1 million on top of it. As I said in that chapter, one of the things I learned in diving in the Nixon archives is the Watergate scandal is just the tip of the iceberg. The Nixon administration was corrupt in every single thing it did, and this is just another example.
In other words, there's a lot closer connection between Hoffa and Nixon than there was Hoffa and the Kennedy assassination, John Kennedy assassination, which the movie tried to portray a little
bit. Yeah, that's rubbish. But yes, there's a huge connection between Hoffa and Nixon, even though they never met. Hoffa, I have Nixon, a quote from one of the recordings when he said he kind of regrets never meeting Hoffa. He said he saw him once in an airplane, but he never met him, but he kind of liked what he saw, kind of a tough guy with American value, traditional American values. But they never met, but their circles intersected a lot, and their fates kind of turned on one another.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on KBUR AM/FM, Burlington, Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. My guest today is Jack Goldsmith, who's actually a professor of law at Harvard University, and he's an author of the book we're talking about today, In Hoffa's Shadow. He's also written a book called The Terror Presidency and the Power Constraint. And from October 2003 to June 2004, he was Assistant Attorney General in the Office of the Legal Counsel in the administration of President George W. Bush. And I'll just say as an aside, you talk about that a little in this book, which is fascinating as well. One of the things I like best about your book was how I had no idea, how Chuckie O'Brien, your stepfather, who is really treated unfairly, I think it's fair to say, most of American culture and in this recent movie and by the FBI, he was also he was taken as a role model to some degree for three famous films that we're all aware of.
Yeah. Yes, he was. He was the godfather based, the godfather consigliere, what's Tom's last name? I can't remember now.
Tom Hagen.
Tom Hagen, sorry.
That's right.
Tom Hagen, believe it or not, was based on, Chucky's character. Mario Puzo did an interview just after the book came out in the late 60s, and the interviewer asked him, who was Tom Hagen based on? Who was that character based on? He said, this guy O'Brien, who is half Irish, half Sicilian, and he's always in Hoffa's shadow, basically. He's always carrying him around, carrying his briefcase, and I modeled him on O'Brien. So that's, I think, an amazing thing that Tom Hagen was based on Chucky.
Mm-hmm.
He was played by Danny DeVito in the earlier Hoffa movie. He was played by Paul Newman in Absence of Malice. That film was based on Chucky's life, even though it wasn't said so at the time. I talked to the Kurt Ledecky, who wrote that film, and he told me that he based it largely on Chucky's character dealing with the Hoffa disappearance. And then, of course, he's played by Jesse Plemons in the Scorsese film. So he's someone that really isn't known, but his life has been the model for a lot of elements of a lot of movies. It's kind of amazing.
You dive deep into the day of the Hoffa disappearance, which I want to have you talk about a little bit. July 30th, 1975. Most authors of previous books about Hoffa, and you go into this in this book, put Chucky O'Brien driving the car, as was seen in the movie The Irishman, not involved directly in the murder, but driving to where Hoffa was dropped off and likely murdered. And you kind of look at that day deeply here and come to a different conclusion.
I do, but let me explain why all the movies and books put Chucky doing that. There's not a single piece of evidence that has him driving Hoffa to his death. There's not a single piece of evidence about what happened to Jimmy Hoffa on that afternoon of July 30th. He just disappeared into thin air. And people have been looking at it for 45 years, and there have been lots of theories, but we just don't know. The reason that all the books and articles put Chucky there is they're repeating the very earliest FBI theory from 1976, where the FBI speculated, since Chucky was driving a car in the area around that time, they speculated that Chucky picked Hoffa up because they thought some of his time was unaccounted for and drove him to his death. And they thought that because they assumed that Hoffa, there are very few people Hoffa would get into a car with, and they thought Chucky was one of them. So that early theory put out by the FBI, which the FBI has since, in secret, unfortunately, not in public, disclaimed, they don't think Chucky was involved anymore. That theory has been repeated with Chucky in the car. It's been the one common thread that's been repeated in every book and article written about this. And that was the basis for him being there. And now I can't prove a negative. I try to be as candid as I can about the evidence for and against Chucky in the book. There are a lot of reasons why he couldn't have been there that day, why he wouldn't be alive if he were involved in it. I have an appendix where I map out the times and places where he was known to be and show why it was practically impossible for him to be there. Everyone who I've talked to have read the book has been convinced, but for me, the most convincing piece of evidence is the FBI itself no longer believes he was involved. They think that someone else did it. They think they know who did it. And they also think, largely for the reasons I gave, not every one of the reasons I gave, because they didn't have all the evidence I had, actually, that he couldn't have been involved. But, you know, a lot more people see the movie than will read my book. So, unfortunately, Chucky passed away a few months ago, but unfortunately, he's going to be tagged with being involved in this, you know, forever.
Yeah, I will just tell our listeners that the appendix, you go through this in detail, and I'm not going to get into a lot of discussion of it because it's worth the price of the book alone. But you have maps there and go into detail about it, how it's would have been almost a physical impossibility for Chucky to be involved in that. You got a chance, as you mentioned, to kind of become close to him again, and you detail in the book a conversation you had late in his life where he really opened up a lot about a lot, not everything, but a lot. Who did he really think was behind this?
He believed that he knew that the organized crime was behind it. He knew that the orders – he didn't know this because anyone told him directly, but he – knew that the orders came from New York, from the so-called commission of the five families in New York, and that it was organized. He believed, he didn't quite put it this way to me, but this is clearly what he thought, it was organized by Anthony Provenzano and Anthony Giacalone. Not at all the way it was portrayed in, and for the reasons it was portrayed in the movie, and it's been traditionally been portrayed, but that they were probably the coordinators. Chucky doesn't know who did it. The FBI currently today thinks it was done by two locals in Detroit. This is not a theory that's really been part of the lore of the Hoffa disappearance. But there's no doubt that the mob was involved. Then we know the reasons why. It's because Hoffa was threatening to blow the whole deal open. And they warned him and warned him and warned him. And Hoffa was basically, in my opinion, practically suicidal at the end of his life. I mean, he wanted the union back. And if he couldn't get it back, he was going to bring everything down. And so anyway, that's the basic story that Chucky told me.
So you've had a chance to look at this movie. You've talked about it a couple times here. Overall, I guess, give your review of it for our listeners, because I've talked to people that have seen that, and they're taking this as gospel truth, that this is what happened. And so, and I say, wait, you got to read this book that just came out that gives a contrary view on it.
Yeah, so there's so many things wrong with the movie. It's really pure fiction, and it's portrayal of the Hoffa disappearance. I've actually written a lot about this in the New York Times, the New York Review of Books, and elsewhere, going into detail about why Sheeran wasn't even in Detroit that day, why the FBI has him on tape admitting that he wasn't in Detroit that day, that he didn't kill Hoffa, he wasn't involved in it at all. Nobody in the FBI, I have six FBI agents on the record saying that there's no way Sheeran could have done it. The whole involvement of Sheeran is science fiction based on a so-called confession he made at the very end of his life trying to get a book deal. And it's just all made up. The whole thing is made up. Sheeran's relationship with Hoffa was nothing like it was in the movie. So it's, you know, it's called true crime, but it's mostly, and parts of it, you know, at the 40,000 foot level, it's true. There really wasn't Anthony Provenzano. There really wasn't Jimmy Hoffa. Scorsese, who himself said he doesn't really care about the truth of the movie in terms of whether he got the disappearance wrong, he weaved this narrative, this powerful narrative. I thought the movie was too long, but it was a good story, into true events and made it seem like everything he did was the story that was told was accurate, but it just wasn't at all.
I guess we'll close with this question, Jack. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about this, because, again, as somebody my age, I'm 61, I mean, this was part of my life growing up. I was very aware of it, and why do you think this continues to hold our fascination? Movies are done about this. It just seems embedded in our culture still here years later.
It's a great question. I've thought about it a lot. I don't have a great answer, but I'll just say this. I think it has to do with the fact that Hoffa was this outsized personality, a larger-than-life figure, this really powerful man, and he just disappeared off the face of the earth on July 30, 1975. There's not a single piece of evidence after 44 years of what happened to him. And so we can all pour our theories and hopes and anxieties into the Hoffa disappearance, and it's just an enduring mystery that, as long as the mystery remains, I think we'll be fascinated by.
It's just like the Kennedy assassination. We have our popular theories, but everybody's got their own, and pop culture extended some of these.
Even with the Kennedy assassination, there's at least some evidence on the surface about what happened. We literally don't have a single shred of evidence about what happened to Hoffa that day. He called his wife at 4:30, said, "I'll be home in 30 minutes. 3:30 in the afternoon, and that was it. That's the last anyone ever heard from him. And there's no evidence, not at all, about what happened to him.
Do you think anything will ever come out about it?
I think one day that the FBI, maybe soon, will close the case and reveal its theory of the case a little bit. It thinks it knows who did it in Detroit. It might not do that, but no. If you're asking me, will we ever find his body and know exactly what happened that afternoon? Even the FBI has no idea, as best I can tell from talking to them, about what actually happened that afternoon. They think they know who was involved because of some surveillance stuff and some informant information. Even that information, evidence is a little flimsy, but they don't know what happened either, and I don't think we'll ever know. I mean, I think Chucky didn't know, and he was the last person alive who was involved, and there's just no reason to think that we're ever going to solve the mystery.
Well, it's a great work. It's a great outstanding writing, and it's a personal story at a personal level that you've wrote, and it of course concerns one of the greatest mysteries in modern American history. But it's great investigative reporting as well, where you went through a lot of documents and were involved directly in talking to the FBI about this. So I congratulate you, and I highly recommend this book to folks for, again, some factual reporting. If you like the movie, great. I did too. But read this book to get another angle on it for more fact-based. Jack Goldsmith's been our guest today. Jack, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me on.